This message comes from NPR sponsor Progressive Insurance, where drivers who switch could save hundreds on car insurance. Get your quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the Broadway musical Funny Girl turned my guest Barbra Streisand into a star, she was getting a lot of attention in 1962 for her nightclub act and for her show-stopping comedic number in the then-new Broadway musical I Can Get It For You Wholesale. That led to her being booked on The Gary Moore Show, which at the time was a popular TV variety show. Here's how she was introduced by Gary Moore in 1962.
You know, one of the biggest thrills for a guy who's been around this business as long as I have is the advent of a bright new young star. Several weeks ago, a very talented 19-year-old newcomer named Barbra Streisand did a comedy song in the Broadway musical I Can Get It For You Wholesale, and she stopped the show cold. Also, in addition to that, she appears nightly at the Bon Soir and kills the people there. But I was delighted to learn during rehearsals this week that she is equally effective in straight numbers as she is when she's being zany. Here, then, is Miss Barbra Streisand.
After that introduction, Streisand performed what became one of her signature songs.
Happy days, I hear again the skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days, I hear again.
Barbra Streisand has a new memoir called My Name is Barbra. Her career got off to a rocketing start. In 1964, she won two Grammys for her first album, the Barbra Streisand album. She was nominated for Tonys for her two Broadway shows. Her first Oscar was for the film adaptation of Funny Girl. She became one of the best-selling recording artists of all time. In 1983, when Yentl was released, she became the first woman to write, produce, direct, and star in a major studio film. A new 40th anniversary release of the Yentl soundtrack includes two discs. The second is largely devoted to demo recordings featuring Streisand. She recorded her end of our interview from her home. Barbra Streisand, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the book. It is an honor to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Terry. Thank you.
Your memoir starts with how early articles about you focused on your nose. Why did you want to start with your nose? It's a 900-page book. Why start with your nose?
Well, what would you have started with?
I don't know. I didn't write the book.
Well, that's what I mean. I had to get their attention, you know, and it was also true. I mean, the articles about me that I remember, I had a researcher that researched me, because I never kept a scrapbook even. And right away, I didn't like being interviewed and being asked certain questions. But even if the interview went well, I noticed that they printed something that was not nice. So what was that about? I never quite understood it. The negativity, you know, like mm-hmm. the picking on my nose wasn't that big ever. I wasn't Jimmy Durante, you know?
Yeah. You initially, well, you decided you weren't going to get it fixed, in part because you were worried it would affect your voice, and for good reason, probably.
Yeah, my first instinct was that I liked my bump, and people would say, oh, you should have your bump removed or something. Why would I remove my bump? And I just had a problem with the tip of my nose, but I wasn't faithful that any doctor would do something so tiny, you know? I probably wouldn't like it. The third thing I thought about was, way later, was, oh, it might affect my voice, my nasal quality, you know, seeming was liked, so why would I change it? Mm-hmm. And I don't like pain. I mean, I've seen people with the bandages on their nose, and sometimes they're not happy, and sometimes they take too much off and you can't put it back. I don't know. I just didn't want to take a chance. And it was expensive, remember? When I was growing up, expensive. We didn't have the money to do anything like that. But, mm-hmm. you know, it just, no. I decided I'll try to just make it on my own and make it about who I was, really.
Early on, when you were starting out, you performed at the Bonsoir, which you describe as a sophisticated nightclub in Greenwich Village. And there's you did a live recording from the club that was never released in 1962 when it was recorded, but it was released last year in a remastered version. So to talk about your early career, very early career, I want to play a track from that. And I thought we'd hear Keepin' Out of Mischief now because it's quite delightful. So here it is, Barbara Streisand, live in 1962.
Keeping out of mischief now, really I'm in love and how. I'm through playing with fire, it's you whom I desire. All the world can plainly see, you're the only one for me. I have told them in advance, they can break up our romance. Living up to all my vows, 'cause I'm keeping out of mischief now. Out of mischief now, I'm in love.
That was Barbara Streisand, recorded in 1962 at the club The Bonsoir. You wanted to be a dramatic actor at first. Why did you think of singing as secondary to drama?
Because I wanted to be on the stage and play, you know, Juliet and A Doll's House, whatever, you know, Ibsen, Chekhov, Shakespeare. And to sing to me in a nightclub was not what I imagined my career to be. Because I knew I had a pretty good voice and I was living with a man who had a great record collection, and he said, there's a club across the street. It was a little club called The Lion. And that manager of that club took me over to the Bonsoir to audition. And that's how I got a job. It was a wonderful job, and I met Phyllis Diller. You know, we shared a tiny little dressing room together. She was great. She was a great friend to me. Bought me a dress because I came out in antique clothes that I thought were beautiful.
And cheap. Yeah.
Yeah, and cheap. Beautiful sequins and gorgeous buckles on the shoes, and you know, from the 1920s, and the top I wore the opening night, it was from 1890.
What?
I mean, the craftsmanship, the boning.
And you got these at thrift stores?
Of course, yeah.
Wow. How did you realize you should try Broadway musicals? So you wanted to be a dramatic actor, then you started singing at a club, and then, of course, you started auditioning.
I went to acting classes where I could play the roles I wanted to play. My first acting class when I was 14, taking the train from Brooklyn to Manhattan, and I tried out for the Actor's Studio when I was 15. So when I didn't get jobs, I decided I had to make a living somehow. I went to that talent contest and won. And that's how I became a singer.
Mm-hmm. So you kept auditioning, and you got a part in I Can Get It For You Wholesale, which was, you know, a musical comedy on Broadway.
I had a wonderful serendipitous, is that such a thing, a word, serendipitous, yeah. I had a wonderful agent who saw me in Another Evening with Harry Stoons, a little off-Broadway play that lasted 9 previews in 1 performance. But he saw me in that. And he's the one who set me up for I Can Get It For You Wholesale, that first Broadway play. Now, you know, it didn't matter to me if I lost roles because I really wanted to be an actress. I mean, that's when I came in and said, you know, when I had to sing they gave me the sheet music for Miss Marmalstein because she was originally written to be an older woman. And they changed it for me. I was only 19 years old. And That's the story I tell, coming back and saying, I'd like to do the song in a chair.
Yeah, she's a secretary, so you wanted to be in like a secretarial chair on wheels.
Yeah, but they didn't have a secretarial chair. But my vision of it was that I would sing the song in a secretarial chair.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, it's logic. It's like I got the job. And then when we started rehearsal, they said, now we're going to stage it. Well, what do you mean? Didn't you like my idea of singing it in a secretarial chair? Well, it was okay, but now we're going to, you know, go to work and do a conceptual, you know, staging with lots of people in the office and so forth.
Yeah, well, what happened to the chairs? Yeah. You kept persisting, like, this is how it should be, and you won.
That's the point. Yeah. The point is I always had these visions of the way things should be. But I also believed in trying to do, to the best of my ability, what the director wanted. I mean, I really tried to make it work for myself, but it just felt so awkward, so not right.
Because you were just like, what, standing around while other people were on stage too? You were just standing and singing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just didn't feel right. And finally, right before we went to Philadelphia, I think that was first, Philadelphia and then Boston. Philadelphia, you know, he said, do it in your goddamn chair. And it stopped the show. I almost felt guilty, but I was happy that it worked.
Why don't we hear it? So this is Miss Marmelstein from 1962 cast recording of I Can Get It For You Wholesale, featuring my guest, Barbara Streisand, who has a brand new memoir.
Miss Marmelstein!
Miss Marmelstein.
Miss Marmelstein.
Miss Marmelstein.
Miss Marmelstein.
Miss Marmelstein.
All the girls get called by their first names right away. They get cozy into May. Do you know what I mean? Nobody calls me, hey baby doll.
Miss Marmelstein.
Or honey dear.
Miss Marmelstein.
Or sweetie pie.
Miss Marmelstein.
Even my first name would be preferable. Though it's terrible, it might be better, it's Yetta. Or perhaps my second name, that's Tessie. Spelled T-E-S-S-Y-E. But no, it's always Miss Marmelstein.
Miss Marmelstein?
You think at least Miss M they could try.
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Miss Marmelstein?
Die.
That's Barbara Streisand in the 1962 original cast recording of I Can Get It For You Wholesale. That is just delightful.
Well, it worked. I was happy about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, you wanted to do dramatic acting, and so, like, your big breakthrough is in a musical comedy. But you were already doing comedic songs.
I didn't get the jobs of the straight shows.
Yeah, why do you think that is? I mean, when you wanted to be a dramatic actress, what kind of roles did you think you'd get? Because when you were young and going to movies to escape being home, basically, you thought to yourself, the girls on screen don't look like me. And they probably didn't, you know.
No, they didn't. They didn't. I mean, the stars, anyway.
Yeah, so what were you expecting to get initially?
Wow. I just somehow always saw my future. I can't explain that to you. Maybe it was my mother's negativity. I don't know if it was like, I'll prove you wrong, because she kept telling me to get a job as a secretary.
Well, you got to play a secretary. That's close.
I sure did. I think it's hard for sometimes parents who would have loved a career for themselves to have their kids become what they wanted to be.
And your mother wanted to be a singer, yeah.
Yeah, she had a beautiful voice, my mother.
Mm-hmm. You know, you write that Elliot Gould, who you met, I think, at the auditions for I Can Get It For You Wholesale, you know, became your husband, and he developed quite a gambling habit.
Which I didn't know for a long time. I didn't know it.
Did you know it during Funny Girl?
I didn't know it at first, that he really had a gambling habit. But it was surprising when I did find out, and then it's part of the reason we broke up, but not really. Mm-hmm. You know, we were both young.
Right.
And it was sweet. I mean, that first day that I auditioned for I Can Get If You Wholesale, I gave people my telephone number, said, you know, somebody please call me. It's like I just got my first phone in my new old apartment. And he called. I remember that was so sweet of him. He said, "Hi, it's Elliot Gould. I saw your audition today. It was brilliant." And he hung up. And we still keep in contact. He calls me. He says, you know, we'll always be family. And it's true. We share a son. So that's great, you know. He gave me my son.
When you were in Funny Girl, were you able to take liberties with the songs? Like, and did that change over time? Were you able to take more liberties as time went on?
In how I sang the songs every
yeah.
night?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh, I had the most wonderful conductor. And he said, you know, he would say things like, tonight you really wanted to speed it up, right? He was right with me, like the great conductors who know that I'm never going to sing it the same twice.
Because you want to be in the moment.
That's right. I want to play with it. Play with the music, you know. Rephrase it depending on how I felt that night. That's what I think keeps a performance honest.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just copy what you did from the night before. You know, it never works, I don't think. I like actors who respect their reality at the moment.
Does this get back to you being shy? And like there's two sides to you. There's the side that's going to like keep pushing for what you want no matter what, no matter how famous the director is or, you know, whoever, you're going to push for what you think is right. And at the same time, the other side of you feels very like shy, very vulnerable, kind of fragile.
Right, right.
So those are like two totally opposite things. Do you feel like at war with yourself sometimes? Like wanting to push and also feeling very vulnerable at the same time.
Well, usually they don't happen at the same time. Usually it's like, no, I have a vision of this and this is what it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like doing, you know, directing my first film, Yentl. I mean, this is what I see in my brain. This is, and now let's improve on that. You know what I mean? It's not necessarily that I do. I have to be open to change. I love being open.
So I want to play a song from the original cast recording of Funny Girl. And I think we played People the last time you were on the show. And so I was thinking of Who Are You Now? It's really beautiful. It's not a song as well known.
Very pretty song, yeah.
Yeah,
very
but it's pretty. A beautiful song. Yeah. Do you want to say anything about the song and what this song means to you?
It was just a wonderful melody and a wonderful lyric. I mean, who are you now? How people change in marriages, or do they or don't they, or how they grow, hopefully together, or how they don't. I love that song.
Good. Let's hear it.
Stronger for my touch.
Barbra Streisand from the original cast recording of Funny Girl. Let's take another break here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbra Streisand, and she has a new memoir, which is called My Name is Barbra. We'll be right back. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. It's easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself too thin. Therapy can provide the tools and self-awareness to help you learn how to recharge, define your boundaries, and build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp Online Therapy. Fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. Support for NPR and the following message come from Carvana, on a mission to make car buying more convenient and affordable than ever before. In minutes, you can browse thousands of options under $20,000. Visit Carvana.com or download the app today to get started.
Over the past couple decades, the U.S. has lost about a third of its newspapers, taking thousands of local journalists off their beat. A functioning democracy and functioning local journalism go hand in hand. We're trying to do our part, and that's why we need you to do your part. Make sure that the NPR network stays strong by supporting us at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
Instead of scrolling mindlessly, engage mindfully with the NPR app. With a mix of on-demand news, stories from this station, and your favorite podcast, you can relax without shutting off your brain. Download the NPR app today.
I'm Anne-Marie Baldonado from Fresh Air. You already know that our show has been around for more than 40 years. And even for us, we love to listen back to our interviews with some of the biggest voices in pop culture. Voices like this one from our latest Fresh Air Plus bonus episode.
I think I had my best conversations with the dog, who was a good friend of mine and didn't challenge me in any way. I certainly let the family know what my needs were. But when strangers came to the house, the mute happened.
That's James Earl Jones in conversation with our host, Terry Gross, more than 30 years ago, speaking about his childhood stutter. You can hear what that meant to Jones for yourself and hear all of our episodes sponsor-free by becoming a Fresh Air Plus supporter at plus.npr.org.
Let's get back to my interview with Barbra Streisand. She has a new memoir called My Name is Barbra. So I want to change the subject a little bit. When did you realize that you'd become a gay icon?
I think quite early on.
Why do you think you became a gay?
I have no idea. Because I could be imitated? Because I had a certain rebel quality, a certain thing that was different, mm-hmm. that they felt when I sang that it was about heartbreak and, you know, a lot of the songs anyway were.
So you met your first husband, Elliot Gould, at auditions for I Can Get It For You Wholesale. So then in your second show, in Funny Girl, you starred opposite Sidney Chaplin, who was Charlie Chaplin's son. He's no longer alive. And you started to think you were falling in love with him because he was falling in love with you.
Yeah, that's flattering. It was flattering. And, you know, that's an occupational hazard sometimes.
Explain.
With actors and actresses. Well, you're playing a part. And then to get to feel something about the person that you're playing with, you sometimes get a crush. Mm-hmm. And he was very attentive to me until it got boring. You know, always wanted to have lunch with me, have dinner with me. No, when we were out of town only.
You called it off. And then
that's right.
He kind of got back at you on stage in front of mm-hmm. audiences. Tell us what he did.
Well, he would mumble under his breath while he was not even looking into my eyes. He was looking at my forehead, and it completely threw me, like saying curse words. And
like cursing you?
Oh, yeah. And I went into his dressing room after the show once or twice to beg him to stop doing that. You know, it's not feasible now. I want to be with my husband, you know. Hopefully you want to be with your wife. That's it. We can't, you know, play games anymore. The show is set. But he wouldn't stop. And it literally, I got sick to my stomach. I was thinking, oh my God, I can't remember my next line. You know, what do I do if I want to throw up and run off stage? I'm on the stage. The first act is an hour and a half.
You were really afraid you were going to throw up on stage.
I was, yeah. I was timing how fast I could get to the bathroom, you know, and it was horrible. I almost was going to quit, but I'm not a quitter. They begged him. I remember seeing him on the stage, and he says, I don't need your money. I got, my father left me a fortune, and, you know, they let him go because he wouldn't stop.
You're right that this is what started your stage fright, that you hadn't had it before.
It's true.
You never did Broadway again.
I never did Broadway again, right.
Was that because of Sidney Chaplin? Do you think if it wasn't for that you would have wanted to be in more Broadway shows?
Not really. I just fell in love with film. I fell in love with doing a scene once or five times or whatever it was in a day or two, and it's over. You don't have to do the same show, say the same words night after night. It became boring. Really, I was ready to move on to and love film. That was amazing. Why would I ever want to go back to Broadway?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm just thinking, like, you have been so brave in pushing for what you think is right in terms of a scene, a performance, the way a song should be interpreted, the lighting, your hair, which side of your face you want to be photographed. But then you started developing these phobias about performing, performing live. So I guess I find it a little hard to square the phobias with the side of you that is so determined and certain. But did the phobias really get to you? Like, did it change your image of yourself to be afraid of one of the things that you do best, which is just like performing live, being on stage?
Sometimes I felt like a clown, like walk back and forth because you have to hit this side of the audience or that side. You know, you have to walk. And then I have back problems. And then my feet started to hurt. You know what I mean? I was just like, this is too strenuous. And then I like the designing the show part. I like imagining it. I loved going back to do my first concert in 1993, New Year's Eve, into 1994. That was exciting for me to, you know, use my experience, use my therapists, you know, and put it into...
Yeah, you had a monologue, but instead of doing it a monologue, you pretended like you were talking to... You know, three different therapists.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had had a woman, I had had an older man, I had had a medium-sized man. But in other words, developing it, designing it is the most exciting part to me.
Yeah.
Not doing it. But I did love, that's in the movies. I loved making the movies I directed because it's so interesting. Yeah.
You credit some of your insecurities to your mother, who was always criticizing you. And I want you to name some of her more memorable and cutting criticisms. I'll start with my favorite of the ones that you mentioned in the book, is that she used to send you bad reviews. And when you'd say, why are you sending this to me? She'd say, you need to know about this. Don't get a swelled head. That's pretty destructive, considering how sensitive you are about some things. So what are some of your most memorable criticisms she made of you?
God. Well, when I first allowed her to, she came the second night when I was at the Bonsoir. My mother, the first thing she said, I remember, was your voice needs eggs. You have to use a guggle muggle because your voice needs to be stronger.
What's a guggle muggle?
A guggle muggle was she made hot kind of chocolate and put a raw egg in it, which I could never swallow. Ugh. My mother came twice, once to see me as a singer and once to see me as an actress. When I came off the stage as an actress in my acting class, we put on a little show, her comment was, "Your arms are too skinny."
So your mother was very critical of you. Your father died when you were 15 months old, so you never really got to know him. Your stepfather you describe as not physically abusive, but emotionally abusive. What did he...
He never saw me. He never talked to me. Mm-hmm. Literally, I can say to you, I don't remember a sentence or even a word hello. It was like I wasn't seen. It's like I vanished in front of him. He would not talk to me. So I think my early upbringing did affect my wanting to be famous in some way or an actor, you know, because I wasn't seen. Mm-hmm. What a way to be seen. You become an actress, I guess, you know. You become a movie star. Yeah.
Right. Let's talk about music. So you are very brave. You a couple of times asked Stephen Sondheim to add a lyric or change a lyric for
yes.
you. And so I want to ask you about Send in the Clowns. In the show that's from, A Little Night Music, you know, it's about a couple who he was in love with her, and then by the time she's in love with him, he's kind of married, so he's no longer available. And, you know, years pass. So anyways, in the song, you thought that since it wasn't done in the context of the show, that people wouldn't get what the lyrics were really about.
So exactly.
So you asked Sondheim to add... A second bridge to kind of explain what was happening. How did you have the nerve to ask Sondheim to write something for you?
You know what? Because I knew him. He had a strange mother like I did, who didn't believe in him.
Right.
And therefore, I could talk truth to him. I know who he is. And I know that he's always, like me in a sense, looking for something even better than what you did before. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are certain people who would never change a lyric.
So what'd you think of the bridge that he wrote for you?
Loved it.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Loved it. I didn't even know, because I don't remember seeing that show. Or if I did, maybe I left at intermission. But I didn't remember the story. And then when he told me, when I called him, he says, you know, you're saying something that really happened on stage. There was time. And you're asking me to write something else that's really filling that time for a record. And he said, so I was really glad to do it.
So we're going to be hearing a little more than just the part that Sondheim wrote for you. So I want to point out to our listeners which is that part in case they're not that familiar with the lyrics. So it's the part that he wrote for you is the part that starts, "What a surprise, who could foresee, I'd come to feel about you what you felt about me." So it's those two lines plus two other lines. Okay, so here we go. This is Barbra Streisand.
Surprise.
That's Barbra Streisand with an extra bridge written for her at her request by Stephen Sondheim. Well, let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbra Streisand, and she has a new memoir, which is called My Name is Barbra. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
If you've never donated to the NPR network before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days, coming up on May 1st and 2nd. Please give at donate.npr.org, and thank you.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
The Indicator from Planet Money is all in on video games. Not just because they're a fun hobby. Video games are one of the fastest growing businesses worldwide, worth more than the film and music industries combined.
We're seeing some games that are really taking, $500 million to make.
We're taking a week-long look at the video game industry. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
So another song I want to ask you about, and this is one of the songs you're most famous for, is The Way We Were, which is the title song from the movie of the same name, which starred you and Robert Redford. And you say originally the song was composed with the melody going down in notes instead of going up in notes. So I'm wondering why it struck you as not being right.
Well, again, you see, these are mystical things. They're magical things. They're one, me. I can't describe it to you. It's why I could write Evergreen, because I hear it in my head. I hear it, and then I have to figure out how you do it. I had to learn to play the guitar to do it. But the way we were, it originally went da 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 da. The original went da 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 da. See? Mm-hmm. I just heard it da 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 da. I went up because that's what I heard in my head. That's what my voice did. It's unconscious or conscious. I don't know how you describe it. It's people who have that ability to do it in the first place, like, you know, Michel Legrand or Marvin Hamlisch. I mean, they write music. And then the song became elevated in my mind, meaning elevated sonically.
I'm forgetting who composed the melody.
Oh, Marvin Hamlisch.
Marvin Hamlisch. Well, so what did Marvin Hamlisch think when you said, by the way, you know, I think the melody should be with the notes heading upward instead of down? Yeah.
He said, good idea. I mean, when you work without ego, when it doesn't matter who says what, you just, when you know it's right, that's great collaboration.
Now, you know how you said when you're working without ego, you take suggestions? And I think because you have so many suggestions and you have such a strong vision in your mind of how things should be, that a lot
right,
of people
or could be,
or
yeah.
could be, that a lot of people perceive you as having a large, domineering ego. What's
well,
your reaction
I don't think
to
it's,
that?
Yeah. I don't think it's ego because, on the other hand, I'm not sure what I do. I'm not sure if this book is any good. I'm not sure if somebody tells me it's fabulous, great. If they tell me, well, it could have been much better, I could buy that too.
Oh, gosh, you know what that's reminding me of?
What?
After your first album came out, Arthur Lawrence, who
that's right.
had directed you in, and I can get it for you wholesale, he wrote you this like horrible letter saying, you know, you're a great singer, but this is too much. It's like putting the frosting on the icing on top of a cake. It's just, it's too much. And he said, but the ingredients are good. You know, the song is good. Your voice is great. But just like take off all that frosting, and you know, you're being too dramatic. And then you wrote him back saying, oh, you're so right. I wasn't
right.
prepared.
I did the album in 3 days, four songs, you know, each session, 12 songs. I didn't know if it was that good. I mean, I didn't.
You topped him in criticisms. You just started tearing the record apart in your letter back to him.
Yeah, that's right.
So that just one more time, I want to say that's another example of the combination of your having a vision and really wanting to do it a certain way and then being really insecure when...
when it's done. Was that really good? I don't know.
Yeah.
My editor keeps saying to me, the book is really good. I say, really? Is it really? You know what I'm saying. I have two sides of me. And one helps the other. No, I don't have a swelled head. My mother didn't have to worry. I never got that swelled head. I believed her.
Right, when she, you know, when she put you down.
When she put me down, that's probably, I'm like two different sides of my personality, yeah. God, I have to go back to therapy, I think. But I'm not that interested in myself again, so I love being interested in grandchildren, my grandchildren.
Thank you for enduring the ordeal of being interviewed.
Well, thank you,
it.
Terry, for, you know, this is 10 years we're talking about.
That you wrote
more
the book.
More than 10 years that I talked to you.
Oh, since you've been on the show. Yes. Well, like I said, it was great
Can
to have
imagine?
You back. Can you imagine?
Okay. Thank you, Terry.
Barbara Streisand's new memoir is called My Name is Barbara.
Misty watercolor memories of the way we were.
After we take a short break, John Powers will review the new Australian comedy series, Colin from Accounts, which premieres in the U.S. tomorrow. This is Fresh Air.
Across America, history is often recorded on small markers. You've probably seen them on the sides of roads, in front of buildings, in the middle of nowhere. NPR's Laura Sullivan spent a year investigating thousands of markers and found a distorted version of America's history, but also curiosities, humor, and joy. Listen to the new episode of The Sunday Story on the Up First podcast from NPR.
The Indicator from Planet Money is a daily podcast that helps you make sense of what's happening in the economy. And video games are a growing slice of that economy, with billions of people around the world identifying as gamers. That's why we're dedicating a week-long series to the growing business of video games. Listen to the Indicator from Planet Money podcast on NPR.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
A new Australian comedy series called Colin from Accounts is about a 40-something man and a late 20s woman who were brought together by a dog. The series begins streaming on Paramount Plus tomorrow, and our critic at large, John Power, says that its warmth, good humor, and essential benevolence might make it the perfect antidote to what's going on in the world.
For most of the 20th century, audiences loved romantic comedies. From Cary Grant wooing Katharine Hepburn to Ted Danson and Shelley Long bickering on Cheers until they finally, inevitably fell in love. Sad to say, this upbeat genre, now direly termed the rom-com, has fallen badly out of fashion, with many younger viewers finding it as passé as black and white movies. If you love romantic comedies as I do, you know it's hard to find a good new one. That's why I happily recommend Colin from Accounts, a new Australian show on the Paramount Plus streaming service. Created by its stars, the real-life husband-wife team of Harriet Dyer and Patrick Bramall, this 8-part series touches all the bases of the traditional romantic comedy. Yet it never feels musty. Brimming with life and honesty, it's also exceedingly funny. Set in Sydney, Colin from Accounts centers on two likably lonely souls, a mid-40s microbrewer, Gordon, that's Bramble, and Ashley, played by Dyer, a hard-drinking 29-year-old medical student who's just broken off with her boyfriend. They share a modern spin on the classic meet-cute. Gordon is driving to work when he stops to let Ashley cross the road. A bit hungover, she thanks him by flashing one of her breasts. The distracted Gordon pulls forward and hits a dog that's been running free. The two take the injured border terrier, which has no ID tag, to the nearest vet. They're horrified to learn that treating the dog will cost them thousands of dollars. As you will surely guess, this accident launches them into a relationship. Initially bound by the dog, which they name Colin from accounts, they gradually discover a more intimate connection. But not before the usual delays. Here we spend time with their friends, from Ashley's even harder partying pal Megan to Gordon's cluelessly ribald bartender Brett. And we watch the two stumble through adventures that take them from hospital deathbeds and inadvertent sexting to drunken revels and wrenching family encounters. Although they don't recognize it at first, we see how well they click. At times, they feel it too. Here, the homeless Ashley has crashed at Gordon's for the night. Over breakfast, they talk about Colin and then start joking around.
This is nice.
This is nice.
Yeah.
Carl, is this nice? High five.
Oh, good boy.
Do you think he's smarter than most dogs?
No.
What?
No, I think everyone just thinks their dog's really smart.
He is very smart.
I can see you becoming like a weird dog person.
Yeah, I'm feeling that too.
I don't know if it's a good color on you.
I think it's a great color on me. No. Get on board.
I'm good. Mm. Look at us, huh?
Yeah.
Like an old married couple. Nice since the kids left.
Oh my God, yeah. Mm.
Now, if you're like me, you may think of Australian comedy as being a tad, well, broad. And in truth, Colin from Accounts is not without its share of flatulence and poop jokes. Pretty funny ones, actually. Yet the show never embraces the gleeful vulgarity of the early Judd Apatow comedies. In fact, the show is striking for its variation of tone. The bawdy stuff is folded into a storyline that grows deeper and subtler as it goes along. Even as they banter, Gordon and Ashley come to know each other's fears and vulnerabilities. In a scene reminiscent of the great Christmas episode of The Bear, Gordon attends Ashley's birthday party at her mother's and discovers the pain of her childhood. Bramble and Dyer are very appealing actors. Bearded and bright-eyed, he gives Gordon a menschy tenderness that shines through his ironic humor. We want him to find happiness. And Dyer may be even better as Ashley. She has a comic verve that recalls Julie Haggerty and Leslie Mann. Yet her tired eyes suggest something more. A woman whose sensitivity and intelligence can be self-defeating. And then there's Colin from Accounts, the dog, I mean, complete with the wheels that do the work of his back legs. I'm pleased to report that the show doesn't use him cutely or milk him for easy laughs. You won't go, aw. The show is smarter than that. Justifying his title role, Colin from Accounts is more than just a dog. He's another wounded, big-hearted creature looking for someone to love.
John Powers reviewed the new series Colin from Accounts, which begins streaming tomorrow on Paramount+. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Isabel Kirshner, a New York Times reporter based in Jerusalem, who's been reporting on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian divide since 1990 and is now reporting on the war between Israel and Hamas. Her new book, The Land of Hope and Fear, Israel's Battle for Its Inner Soul, is about ideological, religious, ethnic, and generational tensions within Israel. I hope you'll join us. To keep up with what's on our show and get highlights of our interviews, follow us on Instagram at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Susan Yakundi. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberto Schorock directs the show. Our co-host is Tanya Mosley. I'm Terry Gross.
On the TED Radio Hour, in the middle school cafeteria, Tai Toshiro always sat with his equally nerdy buddies.
The socially awkward kids who were the furthest thing from cool.
And he often wondered,
why am I so socially awkward and what am I going to do about that?
Now Tai is a psychologist and expert on awkwardness, and he has some answers. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
With more and more information coming at you all day, every day, it can be hard to know where to focus. The new Consider This newsletter from NPR can be that focus. Every weekday afternoon, we take one of the day's biggest stories and break it down in a simple, skimmable format so you can get a better grasp of one important topic and what it means for you in a couple of minutes. Sign up for free at npr.org/considerthisnewsletter.
Here at Planet Money, we bring complex economic ideas down to earth. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain the way money shapes our lives. Inflation, recessions, the price of gas, we've got you. Listen now to the Planet Money podcast from NPR.